netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for taking the time to download our podcast today. I'm John Montgomery. Our guest is Sheena Dougal, a longtime friend, actually, of Jeff, Mike, and myself. So it's great to have Sheena on the FX Podcast. She served as VFX supervisor for the recently released Sex and the City 2. Now, for those of you who don't know, a good chunk of that film was actually set in Abu Dhabi, which is a city in the United Arab Emirates. What's interesting is that the completed film isn't actually able to be seen in the country, and that's because the UAE's regulatory body, the National Media Council, said that, quote, the theme of the film does not fit with our cultural values. And in fact, it's not just a showing thing. They weren't actually able to film the movie in Abu Dhabi. So the principal photography for that section was actually done in Morocco. So a good chunk of the VFX work was actually taking the Morocco surroundings and then placing it into the much more modern Abu Dhabi. So a lot of the work in the VFX, while obviously nothing like Spider-Man or Transformers or anything like that, it was actually done to actually place the characters in the appropriate location. So let's go ahead and join that conversation now, where Mike talks with Sheena about that, as well as the opening sequence that was filmed in New York City, and what it's like to be a woman in a profession that's, quite frankly, very much dominated by men.
And I'm joined on the line now by Sheena. Sheena, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Michael?
Good, good. It's been a while since we spoke. I think it was on Ridley Scott's film Body of Lies. I think we last spoke about 2008. How are you?
Good, thank you very much.
So you've just finished with Sex and the City 2, which is now in cinemas. That must have been an interesting project for you. How'd you get involved in that?
Actually, I was approached by Warner Brothers, who I'd worked with on Body of Lies. And actually, that movie was shot in Morocco and Sex and the City 2 was shot in Morocco. And so that was one of the reasons the filmmakers had seen that work, and they were specifically interested in me. And also, you know, obviously it's a visual effects film aimed at women, and so I think it was a good fit just in terms of, you know, taking visual effects and looking at them from a female perspective.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, actually. I was going to discuss that later, but now you've mentioned it. I think it's terrific that you've been so successful as a woman. I just feel a bit like I wish there were more women like you. It seems that you've managed to succeed where many others have been somewhat limited by glass ceilings. Do you feel in any way conscious of that fact, or is it just something that you've dealt with a long time ago?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't used to feel conscious of that fact. And on this film, I became a little bit more conscious of that fact because, you know, I've spent many years working on you know, the types of films that are, you know, not really aimed at women. I mean, I've worked on Spider-Man. I've worked on action films, you know, with Ridley and comedies as well. But it's a different kind of requirement, I think, for visual effects when you're, you know, creating something for something like Sex and the City 2 than, say, for, you know, Body of Lies or Spider-Man 3. And so you're sort of talking about things in very different terms.
I mean, I guess I'm sure that you were hired because of course, the relationship with the studio and stuff from Body of Lies. Nevertheless, it must have been nice on a film that is, for many women, been a voice of empowerment for women to be a senior head of department that was a woman. It must have not been lost on, I guess, a few people.
No, I think the filmmakers were really actually excited that they had a female visual effects supervisor on the film. And, you know, we had to talk about how to make things elegant and beautiful and pretty and sparkly. And so, you know, I think that possibly for a lot of the guys out there doing visual effects on a film like this may have been a bit of a stretch.
I mean, it's a comedy, and it's also, I guess, doesn't take itself too seriously. That being said, it's not of the slapstick variety. So I guess there's that line to be walked where you're doing, and you've done this before in other films like Anger Management and a bunch of others, that it has to be funny and the visual effects have to also work in a completely seamless way. In a sense, you don't want anyone to see your gags.
Right. Yes, exactly. And, you know, actually, most of the comedies I've worked on, the visual effects have been a big part of actually, you know, getting the idea of a joke across. But on this particular film, this whole second act of the movie is set in Abu Dhabi, and the filmmakers weren't able to shoot in that location. We actually ended up shooting, as I mentioned before, in Morocco. And so what we were having to do for the visual effects is actually make Morocco look like Abu Dhabi in the Middle East, which was quite challenging because, you know, we're shooting on locations where we're out in the desert. And our goal is to make it have a setting and a location for the hotel in the film, which is by the ocean and on a lagoon. So, you know, that was very challenging to achieve that when we were actually shooting in a desert location.
Yeah, and of course the whole point, I guess, of that Middle Eastern plot point is it's very lush and quite you know, rich with money. I don't think of Morocco in the same terms as I think of the Middle East.
Not at all. I mean, Morocco's really old and really dusty, and then architecturally, you know, some of the design of the buildings is quite different. So that was a big part of what we, you know, had to put energy into together with the production designer, Jeremy Conway, was sort of figuring out, you know, the look and how we were going to achieve, you know, the feeling of it being transformed into this sort of lush Middle Eastern environment. And
I was going to say, you just worked on some really huge effects counts. I mean, you know, I love the sequence you did, for example, in the baseball sequence in Superman Returns.
Yeah.
I guess by shot count, this film isn't a huge effects film.
Not at all. I think it was about 160 visual effects shots in the end. But what was interesting was, you know, and I think this is a new paradigm that's happening across the board, especially on these types of films, which don't have a lot of visual effects in them and aren't really visual effects-driven movies. You know, that work is being supervised by one person who's the supervisor for production side, and then there are multiple visual effects houses working on that. And on this project, we worked with CIS in Hollywood. We work with ImageWorks India. We work with Digiscope in Santa Monica. We work with Imaginary Forces, both in Los Angeles and New York. And then we had a few individuals, Ivo Hovart and Dick Edwards, that we work with who are based here in LA.
Yeah, I was really keen to talk to you about for that reason, because last week on the show, we had a discussion about independent post at the commercial level. And I guess at the feature film level, we are very often drawn to the big effects films that are clearly done by the major houses, of course, many of whom you've worked at for many years. And there's nothing wrong with that. But there is, as you say, a real need for almost any major film to have a visual effects component. And it does seem that there is a possibility of hiring more freelancers and individuals and sort of putting your own team together. If you were going on to another film, it wouldn't necessarily be a Sex and the City film, but any sort of film with a couple of hundred shot count, how viable is it for you to just put your own team together, or did you always want to be farming out to facilities?
It's an interesting question, actually. I think these days there are a lot of people that I know out there who are extremely talented, and the idea of putting a team together, you know, like we did back when we used Flame the first time, you know, in 92, and as they did, I think, on 2012 more recently, you know, it becomes a more feasible prospect as opposed to, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, there wasn't as much talent out there. Most people are attached to a facility. But, you know, there are pluses and minuses to all of the different ways of approaching this as well. The advantage of using a facility is, you know, there's a certain sort of amount of reliability that you get in terms of, you know, meeting schedules and meeting delivery dates, and you don't have like a single point of failure in the same way that you do if you're, you know, going to one individual person.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously worked at ILM and for many years at Sony Pictures ImageWorks and done great work there, but I can't imagine a film like a Spider-Man going to anything but one of those. But
absolutely, yeah.
For some of these other films, especially when you've got a strong relationship with the director, it must sort of close the loop a little in making sure that he or she or their vision is easily maintained through you to the artist when you've got a tighter loop of individuals and less kind of layers of management, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, that's true too. You know, it's really just coming down to budget. these days. And, on, you know, we didn't have a huge visual effects budget. This was not meant to be a visual effects movie. So, you know, I think what we had to do was, you know, find really efficient ways of solving the problems.
And yet, of course, a very valuable property and a very, you know, much loved franchise. And so clearly couldn't take any compromises. And I wanted to discuss, if we can, we like to do this a single sequence just to get an idea on how you did it, sort of drill down a little. And the one I'm going to pick, if it's all right with you, is the opening of the film. Because I think it's a good sequence for a couple of reasons. One is that in many respects, an artist like yourself who's reached a very senior level as a supervisor almost acts as a second unit director to many viewpoints. I know that you're the supervisor, but you actually directed a bunch of that opening sequence as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I actually met with Michael Patrick King, the director, and we had a chat about... I actually showed him the piece that I did for Chicago Spire, and we, you know, we talked about some of the ideas that he had for the titles, and he wanted to create something that just... I think the word he used was frenzy. He wanted to sort of build... build an opening to this film like you might get on, you know, a guy's film, like a superhero film.
Right.
So sort of one of the briefs was, you know, and we've sort of jokingly, you know, called this Batman for girls on some level. So, you know, one of the things that we wanted to achieve was something that had that kind of excitement and that kind of impact you would have on, you know, big blockbuster superhero movie.
You've got this very high production value requirement because, of course, we want the film to be luscious and have high production values. And so your solution is to get one of the other characters of the film, New York, into the opening title sequence. Tell me, what did you actually shoot for that sequence and what was computer graphics? And also, if you could, just explain some of the limitations in shooting.
Right. So how that sequence actually came about was we did pre-visit, but of course, you know, once you get up in a helicopter, you're looking at the world in a completely different way than you are when you're flying a camera around in the computer. So we pre-visited it, but once I actually went up in a helicopter with a nose-mounted space cam.
Right.
And we had, you know, I had a shot list and I had a pretty good idea of what it was that I wanted to shoot. We had a very limited window of time. There were storms coming in the previous day and the day we actually shot. And we sort of got up there for, we went up at about 6:30 and we lost the weather around 2. And obviously we were shooting film, so we were going up and down. I think we landed and took off maybe 6 or 7 times. And so I had a shot list of what I wanted to get. But once I got up there, I sort of realized that some of the stuff I designed was going to be a bit challenging to shoot because I had the idea behind those title sequences was that we wanted to show you New York in a way that the audience had never really seen it before. And we wanted to show it in a way that paid homage to, you know, the sparkle and the glitz of the town and of the film itself. So we decided that showcasing New York reflected in itself in the windows of the tall skyscrapers was going to be an interesting way to go. And you know, for me, I'd actually done an aerial shoot for Santiago Calatrava's Spire in Chicago, and one of the things that had struck me, you know, flying through that skyscraper skyline was, you know, the buildings kind of sparkle like jewels when they hit the light. You know, they're these glass buildings, and they're often very reflective. And as you travel around them in the helicopter, you can pick up some amazing light and reflections. So you know, I went up there and we got enormous amount of footage in camera that was, you know, really, really useful. And, you know, obviously we couldn't shoot everything that we required for the entire sequence. So we used Cinema 4D and we created some entirely CG shots, which I hope aren't too obvious.
you also, well, before I can get to those Cinema 4D shots, you are seemingly incredibly close to the Chrysler Building, closer than I'd want to be if I was in a helicopter. What sort of lens were you on? I mean, how is it?
We were on an 11:1 zoom lens, right, on the space cam, and I was very fortunate to get Al Cirillo as the pilot, who he's famous for shooting New York. And that's sort of a slightly interesting story because he's used to doing things, movies like Iron Man. I think he was the pilot on Iron Man, and maybe on a couple of other big action films that I can't recall right now. And so we are up there shooting these very macro type of shots. You know, I mean, most people go up above New York and they shoot wide aerial shots. So we were shooting these very slow, very controlled, very macro, trying to capture very specific things. And I think that both the DP and the pilot were kind of having this moment where they weren't quite sure what was going on. What's this girl? Why is this girl asking us to shoot all this sparkly stuff, you know? And I was just going in and beautiful light and it being elegant. And it was very different language than what they were used to, I think.
It's funny, isn't it? Because what's obviously works in the film are tiny snippets because it's a cutty sequence.
Right.
It must have been hard for you because, I can imagine a pass on the building where you think you got it, but you only got it for 48 or 59 frames or something. And yet that's all you need, right?
Yeah. Well, the other thing that you have to be is relentless and sort of, make them do it again and again. You know, even though we think we've got it, I went and did quite a few safety takes, and we went up very early in the morning, about 6:30 in the morning. So the lighting was changing quite drastically. And when we started, we were the Chrysler Building was reflecting golden light, and then after a few hours, it became silver. So we were able to photograph that as well, which was really magical and fantastic. And also, the other restriction, there's a lot of restrictions with flying over New York as well. So
yes, I can only imagine.
So we were in constant communication with the police and the city and, about what we were doing and what we were allowed to do and what we should stop doing. So,
Did you ever consider shooting that digitally, given that the reload problem was so taxing?
Yes, we did consider shooting it digitally, but ultimately it's the DP's decision.
Right. So let's move on to there was a role played, I presume, in the text by Imaginary Forces. Is that right?
Yes.
So this is one of those classic cases where you farmed out a bit of work. Imaginary Forces is doing type design, which obviously they're very good at doing. And then you had, an individual or a freelance team that was actually doing the animation for you?
Well, actually, Imaginary Forces did the graphic design for the text. They also, did the conform for that title sequence, and they also did the visual effect shots that at the opening. So the shots where you're flying through the CG clouds and then down onto the Manhattan Island, where you see it turn into diamonds. That was also Imaginary Forces. So, no, I wanted to also mention Ivo Hovart, who's just a really talented matte painter, 2D and 2.5D matte painter. And he created a lot of the reflection shots for me that I wasn't able to get in camera for the open title sequence.
Now, was that a case of producing a 3D model of the building and reflecting photography that you'd shot in the building, or did they have to make the model up of the reflection as well?
No, exactly what you described, yeah. And with some enhancements. I mean, Ivo went in and painted enhancements into the photography that was being projected onto the geometry, just, where we needed it to just be that little bit more elegant and sparkly and fantastic and fabulous.
Yeah, because there are some pings and stuff coming off the Chrysler building that would almost be too good to be true.
that artistic license we were waving around.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough too. I mean, you want it to be exactly that. And also just the flock of birds, I presume that you weren't lucky enough to actually get those?
No, the flock of birds were done by a company here in LA called Custom Film Effects. So we had a lot of different people collaborating on this.
So there's a sequence that in of itself is not as complex as some of the ones you've done in your career, but nevertheless, it's this new model of you working with a freelancer here, a company there, and integrating them all together. And just for you personally, how do you find that?
It was an interesting experience for me, having worked in a big facility like ImageWorks for the last 14 and a half years, because I'm used to having a lot of different people collaborating together to create something, but I'm also used to having a team of people around me who basically sort of do all the data management and a lot of the communication. So I'm used to saying, okay, I want this to happen and that to happen, and somebody's taking notes, and there are other people sort of facilitating all of that to happen. And, you know, obviously in this kind of scenario, that I'm responsible for doing all of that. So it's not just getting the feedback to all the individual people. It's sort of working with my producer. And I had a fantastic partner on this, Jackie Barnbrook, who was in Morocco with me. And she was also in Morocco with me on Body of Lies. And we've done a few projects together. So that was you know, the part for me that was really helpful. But, yeah, it's really challenging. It's a completely different way of working, and it's as a visual effects supervisor, when you're managing multiple vendors, it's a lot more work.
I'm glad you brought up that point about a producer, because I was going to ask you about that. It seems to me that, and we very rarely discuss this, so I'm glad you brought it up, that to get this to work well, you really need to have a very good producer and presumably line producer, because that amount of juggling outside the, you know, let's face it, Sony or an ILM is very, very good at the process of producing visual effects. And so outside that support environment, you must have a real need for some very good and sort of self-motivated producer, line producer types.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jackie is just, you know, my heroine in that regard. I mean, she just did an excellent job staying on top of everything and really helping me out. And we also had vendors in India. So, you know, it was almost like visual effects 24/7, because they were going to bed when I was getting up. So the first thing I would do is, I'd get on the phone with them, or I'd get on, CineSync with them and talk about the work and look at the work that they had done. And we, you know, we were basically, using FTP sites to, keep in touch with all of the different vendors. We had, you know, a lot of stuff happening in a very short schedule, and you know, we were having to look at it and give feedback and you know, in a very, very timely fashion in order to meet our deadlines. I would be critiquing the work from the previous day when I got up in the morning,
right?
And then when I, at the end of my day, they would be starting their day, and they would have addressed some of the notes that I had made.
That's excellent.
In the morning. And so, yeah, so they were really long days.
Now, look, just, I don't want to get into any specifics, but just in general terms, if you work independently like this, and obviously you're working for the production, is there, does the visual effects supervisor in your role have to get more concerned with the budget and how it runs? Because obviously a big company like Sony has also a huge accounts kind of thing, whereas you're much more, I presumably, unable to tolerate overages if it's your unit. So without getting into any specifics, is it more onerous on the visual effects supervisor working this way just from a financial point of view or not?
I actually don't think so, because on all the movies I've worked for while I was at ImageWorks, I think for the most part, I was working directly with production. Even though I was the facility supervisor, I was responsible for the overall production.
Right.
So I feel like I've always tried to have fiscal responsibility with what I do. I mean, I personally feel that that's a big part of our job, is, you know, not just to understand the director's vision and communicate creatively with his vision to all the different artists and people that we're working with, but it's also, you know, to deliver on budget.
Yeah, I guess you've done films of a similar ilk, in addition to obviously the big budget ones we've been referring to. And I guess on those, because, you know, there are some great films that you did. I particularly like the prize winner of Defiance. I just thought that was a great film. Never seemed to get a lot of attention, but
I know. It's kind of surprising. I love that film. I thought it was just a great story, a true story, and it had great people behind it. I mean, Zemeckis was one of the executive producers, Steven Spielberg, Joe Roth. But it just didn't, unfortunately, do terribly well, or I don't think it got noticed.
Yeah. But having said that, I mean, that's sort of a film where it's, again, not an effects film, but clearly you're in a lead position running a department, would have had, I presume, therefore, the sort of similar managerial responsibilities from that point of view.
Yes, yes. And, you know, and that was an interesting one because the visual effects were sort of whimsical and designed to be 1950s type of animation. So you walked a really fine line between making it look cheesy because it was more crude than anything we're used to seeing now, and in order to sort of pay homage to it being like a 50s type of feel. So that had challenges for different reasons. But, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
So are we allowed to ask what you're doing next? Now you're on your own, or rather you're setting up presumably to supervise independently.
I am, and maybe even direct too. I have some things going on, but I can't really talk about them right now.
It seems to me that it's surprising that fewer visual effects supervisors don't go on to direct, because as we've already discussed in this, you end up doing quite a lot of second unit directing and, of course, work very closely with the director.
Yeah. The second unit directing is actually a lot of fun. I really enjoy that aspect of the job. You've got greater control, I think, over what the vision is when you get the opportunity to do that, as opposed to typically as a visual effects supervisor, you may sort of end up with some different pieces of footage that have been shot, and it's your job to figure out how to make those pieces of footage, you know, work together, and you don't always get your best foot forward that way, you know, and it's a different sort of level of responsibility when you get to, you know, be in charge of directing the photography as well as doing the visual effects.
Just one point on that. You mentioned it earlier that working with the DOP, with your second unit work, were you working with the primary DOP or was there a second unit DOP as well?
No, with the second unit stuff, we actually had, for the aerial unit, we had an aerial DP. And then when we were in Morocco, I'm going to go back and talk about my producer again now, Jackie, because I actually went out to Morocco without a producer, and it became clear really quickly that we were going to need a visual effects unit to, you know, shoot all the plates that we needed to go with the first unit photography. And so Jackie came out, and we ended up putting together a visual effects unit, and which we brought in from the UK. So we had a crew, UK crew. They were brilliant. They were really cool. And we grabbed the Luma crane from first unit when we could, and we ran around, you know, getting as much as we possibly could, and that was a really you know, excellent experience for both Jackie and I, because you know, first unit had so many challenges of its own, just because it's a very challenging place to shoot. You know, we basically sort of put this unit together and we're just sort of off on our own with this unit.
There's a slightly kind of rebel feel to second unit, isn't there? It's a bit like whatever first unit's not using, you kind of steal, beg and borrow.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly what we were doing in this scenario. We were, like, trying to steal, beg and borrow cameras, people, lenses, you know, equipment.
All for a good cause, of course.
For a good cause. And I still have my Luma kiss on my forehead from, unfortunately, walking into the crane, the Luma crane. It's easily
sorry,
done.
I shouldn't laugh.
No, it's easily done in a hot country when you're wearing a sun hat, because you don't. That the peak on the sun hat, I walk straight into the crane. I still have a mark on my head from it, and that was in December. So,
cripes. Well, yeah. Hopefully you can sit back with a Cosmopolitan and enjoy the film. And thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
As always, we really do appreciate the time that our guests take to actually chat with us here on the FX podcast. And thanks, Sheena, for doing that. We've had really fantastic production folks, manufacturers, and VFX supervisors really share some knowledge that, quite frankly, I don't think you get anywhere on the net. So I really appreciate the kind of detail that they bring and are open with providing to us. Before we close out, I just want to take a moment to mention that we are announcing our new term over at FX PhD on July 1st stateside. Mike, myself, and everyone at FXPHE has worked really hard to get a stellar lineup of new courses, really running a great range of types of courses too for the summer term. So check back at fxphd.com on July 1st for our new lineup. Well, that's it for this week. For my partners, Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.